Life of Jesus, a devotional study by Melva Purkis. Book 5, Chapter 5, Feeding Other Sheep. From the borders of Tyre and Sidon, Jesus and his small band of disciples turned eastwards into the mountains of northern Galilee, travelling probably across the foothills of Lebanon and Hermon, with their high gorges and swirling torrents. It was a long and lonely journey which would give Jesus abundant opportunity for instructing the 12. He would be able to discuss with them the adventures they had had on their mission without him, the problems that had presented themselves, the difficult decisions they had been forced to make. And listening to them, Jesus would help each one according to his temperament, giving advice which would guide them in the years ahead. He would tell them something of what discipleship meant as both a privilege and a responsibility. There can be little doubt that during the arduous days that followed their Lord's ascension, they would often call to mind the things he told them on some vividly remembered occasion, when perhaps the evening sun was striking the topmost peaks of Hermon, turning the powdered snow into a rosy pink, when the foaming waters were splashing and eddying through the rocky chasm, and the mountain pines were leaning against the steeply rising cliffs until they were lost on the snow line. Precious moments, these. Moments not denied even now to those who leave the crowded shore and seek to be alone with Christ. How long this joyful sojourn in the mountains lasted we cannot tell, but at last it ended, and they took the road southwards through Iturea, reaching the eastern shores of the Sea of Galilee from the province of Decapolis. Long before they had their first glimpse of the rich blue of the sea, Jesus had been recognized. They had travelled through the country of the Gergesenes, where Legion, now a peaceful evangelist, was spreading abroad his fame. It may well be that the seed he had sown had brought forth fruit. When Jesus reached the top of a mountain, he was besieged by a multitude of people, bringing with them their blind, dumb, and maimed. This was the first time such a scene had occurred outside the confines of Israel, and it had a profound effect upon these semi-Gentile people who glorified the God of Israel. The scene must have surprised the disciples, who themselves had been carefully instructed to go only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But it was a scene which foreshadowed the time, not far distant, when the blessings which had been confined to the Jews since the days of Abraham would be extended to embrace all mankind. Mark singles out one particular miracle at this time. The people brought to him a man who was deaf and, probably because of his deafness, suffered also from an impediment in his speech. It is an inspiration to watch Jesus deal with this man who cannot hear the word of life nor cry for release from his infirmity. Jesus led him away from the multitude and, entering into his limitations so that he might draw forth the man's faith, he healed him by signs. First he plunged his fingers into the deaf ears, moistening his own finger with saliva, he touched the tongue that was tied, then looking up to heaven to direct the afflicted man's attention to the true source of his healing, he sighed. None of these actions had produced any result, but they had given the man an understanding which was the seed-bed of faith and the preparation for blessing. At last he spoke, "Ephphatha, be opened." And Mark tells us straightway his ears were opened, and the string of his tongue was loosed, and he spake plain. Jesus charged him, and those of his friends who had left the multitude to witness the miracle, to tell no man. but as on previous occasions, they published it the more. And so, with many of the works of Christ, this miracle has features which give cause for reflection. We notice that Jesus drew the man away from the crowds that he might heal him. The reason was probably to take him from influences which would distract his attention during this supreme preparation of faith. Alone with Jesus, he could concentrate upon him and understand the meaning of every gesture he made. There are times when such a process is necessary for the spiritual healing of those who follow. The Lord God has given his Son the tongue of the learned, that he might speak a word in season to him that is weary. Sometimes our ears are dull of hearing, and when they are, we usually find that we have also an impediment in our speech. To take us away from the multitude to the isolation of a sick bed, or into that mental detachment which comes from solitude, is perhaps the only way towards the healing which would give us ears to hear the joyful sound of his gospel and voice to speak forth all his praise. For 3 days the people stayed with Jesus as he healed their sick. Whether he taught to these Gentiles the things of the kingdom we do not know. But there can be no doubt that he had words of comfort and guidance for them, which would be a preparation for the evangelizing work of the apostles in a few years' time. Now the hour of his departure had come. His work at Decapolis had been short. He was leaving them, and they would not see his face again. But his love was with them to the end. As he was about to go, he saw their need. They had been with him for 3 days. To send them away would mean that many of them would faint before they reached their homes. Once more he was moved with that tender compassion which needed so little encouragement to flow out in loving service. Once more the disciples failed to believe that his power was as great as his love. When should we have so much bread in the wilderness as to fill so great a multitude? As if to remind them of the occasion a few weeks ago, only a few miles along the same shore, Jesus repeated his question, "How many loaves have ye?" Whether the question was a rebuke to their faith, we do not know. They answered simply, "Seven, and a few little fishes." Having commanded the people to sit down, Jesus once again blessed the bread and gave it to the disciples to distribute. All were filled, and 7 baskets were taken up. 4,000 men, beside women and children, had been fed. There is a footnote here which I will read. 2 interesting points of contrast between the feeding of the 5,000 and 4,000 emerge. A. The first miracle occurred earlier in the year when the grass was lush and green. Mark mentions the green grass in chapter 6, verse 39. John says, "Now there was much grass in the place," in chapter 6, verse 10. The second miracle happened when the early grass had been burned up. In both records, the writers simply say that the people sat on the ground. B. Different containers were used to collect the fragments of the 2 miracles, but both words are translated baskets. Those used for the second miracle seem to have been larger, for Paul was let down from the Damascus wall in one. The distinction is invariably made in all the gospel references. Thus, when Jesus warned the disciples against the leaven of the Pharisees, he says, "Do ye not remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000, and how many baskets ye took up? Neither the 7 loaves of the 4,000, and how many panniers ye took up?" Matthew 16, verse 9 to 10. There are indications that the 12 baskets of the first miracle were in fact the 12 disciples' dinner baskets. This suggestion will bring many fruitful thoughts, particularly the connection between John 6 verse 12 and John 17 verse 12. But we will return to our reading. It may be difficult to understand the attitude of the disciples on this occasion. There is abundant evidence in Scripture to show that they do not stand alone. Israel and even Moses himself failed in the midst of evidence of God's power. It is easy to take an optimistic view of the faith we expect in others. The real test must always be with ourselves. There is just the possibility that the disciples had not forgotten the previous occasion, nor doubted their master's power, but did not expect it to be manifested toward the Gentiles as it had been to his own people. Such an attitude would make their question tentative rather than doubting. The two miracles of feeding, taken together, can be found to have spiritual significance. Jesus came to his own to feed them first, but when they refused him, he departed and offered bread to the Gentiles. The hesitancy of the disciples to understand the first ministration and their reluctance on the occasion of the second lends strength to this typical interpretation. So Jesus departed across the lake to the coast of Magdala. The long Galilean ministry had virtually closed. The short one at Decapolis was at an end. Both had concluded with a feast provided by Jesus. Our thoughts go forward to the close of the Judean ministry. We find Jesus eating the Last Supper with his disciples, not indeed on a mountain, but in an upper room. The 5,000 who followed him become 12. Then 11. He will not ask them now, "Will ye also go away?" Following the traitor out into the night, they will presently leave him. But the feast will not be interrupted by their departure. The bread will be broken, and in its breaking the apostles will be united to their Lord, and to them down the centuries will be joined disciples from both the Galilean and the Decapolis shore, all awaiting the final feast when their Lord and Master, returned from his Father's side, will eat bread and wine in his kingdom. Chapter 6, 11. Jesus had hardly reached the familiar western shore of the lake after his long absence, when he was challenged by Pharisees and Sadducees who came forth to meet him, and tempting him, demanded a sign from him. The presence of Sadducees so far from the limited confines around Jerusalem is some indication of the alarm which was intensifying there as the popularity of Jesus spread through Galilee. The demand for a sign would not have been an insult had not the actions and words of Christ been constantly supported by the authority of his miracles. It was the responsibility of the leaders of Israel to test a prophet by asking a sign, as in Deuteronomy 13, and their rabbinical writings show a number of cases where it was asked and given. Here was a prophet who set at naught the tradition of the elders, who broke their precepts and whose teaching differed gravely from theirs in several important particulars. Moreover, he had openly countercharged them with hypocrisy when they had opposed him. They acknowledged his power, but not its source. How easily Jesus could have satisfied their request. He could have left them pale and trembling by the might at his command. But that was not the way of Jesus. He allowed them to be their own judges. Because of the hardness of their hearts, that was the worst punishment they could have for their contempt of the Son of God. there would be weeping and gnashing of teeth. He who comes to Christ, whether in challenge or inquiry, cannot demand a spectacular display of power. Enduring trust will come from a gradual appreciation and an assimilation of love, a love that glows in humble glory. Such trust finds its birth in the dimly lit stable of a crowded inn, and leads on to a lonely Son of Man carrying the burden of all humanity to a rough wooden cross outside the city wall. These Pharisees and Sadducees had not learned this. Countless of their countrymen had learned it, and so had a Roman centurion and a Syro-Phoenician woman. The great army of Galileans, glowing with restored health, had no message for these supercilious leaders from Jerusalem. They needed a sign from heaven. They tempted him. Did Jesus know that at this very place, less than 40 years hence, the sea would be dyed with Jewish blood when the armies of Vespasian marched upon Galilee from the north? He sighed deeply in his spirit. He understood their motive. He knew their hardness. He foresaw the ruin they were bringing upon themselves and their country. Only a wicked and an adulterous generation would seek a sign in Israel at this time. He refused the demonstration they asked for, but he gave them a warning. They looked into the heavens in the morning and the evening, and from the colour of the sky they could discern the signs of the approaching weather. Could they not lift up their heads in Israel and see the signs of a coming storm? Their present mission was an omen. Yes, he would give them a sign. The sign that the Ninevites received when their judgment appeared imminent. The sign of the prophet Jonah. The people of Nineveh accepted the preaching of Jonah. The 3 days was a sad and terrible symbol. If it was ignored, that threatening storm would break over their heads with a relentless fury Nineveh had not known. Having given them a sign which could have proved greater than any display of power, had they the desire to have received it, Jesus left them and went with his disciples into the boat. They now embarked upon a further journey away from the crowds towards the northern mountains. They beached their boat on the desert shore of Bethsaida Julius, the place which had been the scene of the first great miracle of the bread. It would appear that Jesus had been silent during the crossing, reflecting on the encounter he had just had with the Pharisees and Sadducees. Immediately upon landing, he spoke to his disciples, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees." The disciples were perplexed by his warning and reasoned among themselves. They finally decided that it must have something to do with the fact that they had forgotten to bring bread. There is a footnote here which reads, "It has been suggested that the disciples thought Jesus meant that they had deliberately forgotten the bread, so that they might receive a sign such as the Pharisees had demanded. Another suggestion is that they thought Jesus was telling them not to take bread from the Pharisees." Neither of these rather forced ideas seemed necessary. It appears more likely that the disciples were confused by their master's words and vaguely felt that they must have something to do with their failure to bring bread. So we continue. Jesus sternly reprimanded them for their lack of faith and reminded them of his ability to supply bread. Then they perceived that he spoke of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Again there is a footnote. Mark substitutes the leaven of Herod for Matthew's leaven of the Sadducees. Some Sadducees emphasized their political interests and became partisans of Herod. These Sadducees were also known as Herodians. So to continue. In warning his disciples against the Pharisees and Sadducees, Jesus did not speak of leaven of each, but of the leaven that was common to the two. We have seen that superficially the two parties were widely different. The one was strict, intensely nationalistic, and preoccupied with ritual. The other was lax, sympathetic to outside culture and philosophy, and sceptical. The leaven of the Pharisees was hypocrisy. The leaven of the Sadducees was materialism. Each had to be avoided. Yet they had joined on the opposite shore in common cause, and therefore the leaven to be particularly careful of was the result of their attitude to Christ. The key to the danger takes us back to the charges Jesus had already laid against them. His accusation was that as sign seekers they were wicked, adulterous, and blind. It was an accusation levelled against them for their common attitude to the things of God. They were all of this world. The Pharisees, in their hypocrisy, used their devotions to be seen of men, and patronizing this world, they had their reward. The Sadducees, in their scepticism and license, made little pretense of seeking anything other than temporal rewards. Both parties joined in hostility against Jesus because he represented the things of God. Both were ungodly, alive to self and dead to God. If our study of the life of Jesus is to bear fruit truly in our own lives, we must be continually learning the lessons in which it abounds. The level against which Jesus warned his disciples has not been destroyed. Hypocrisy is not extinct, nor materialism. They unite in that baser leaven of ungodliness which can by its very nature permeate our lives and estrange us from Christ and his kingdom. Before Jesus and his disciples left the village of Bethsaida to begin their journey northwards, the people brought a blind man and besought Jesus to touch him. He did not comply with their request. Instead, we have the moving and significant picture of Jesus leading the blind man by the hand and taking him out of the town into the country, where he would be free from the embarrassments of the crowds, and where his first vision would be of the creative works of God and of the Saviour who was the beginning of God's new creation. This healing differs from similar miracles because it was performed gradually. First, Jesus put his own saliva on the man's eyes and touched them and asked him if he saw. The man looked up and with blurred vision saw in the distance the crowds from the town coming out towards him. "I see," he said, "men as trees, walking." Once more Jesus touched him, and this time looking up he saw every man clearly. We may wonder why Jesus thus delayed the perfect cure. Without the instruction afforded by the record, we do not know. Even then we can only reverently surmise, being careful to avoid presumption. Thus it would seem, as it has often been shown in the Gospels, that the answer lies in the imperfect faith of the sufferer. This man did not come to Jesus himself. He was brought to him by the townsfolk. Even when he stood before him, he had no word of supplication. The people appealed on his behalf. In this we see a further object in Jesus leading him out of the town. As we have noticed before in cases of immature faith, Jesus sought to perfect it in the process of healing. Thus, when the blind man looked up to see, even dimly, for the first time, his faith would soar, and he would believe that Jesus could complete the cure. Thus prepared, the second touch perfected his sight. The restored man was told to avoid the town and go straight to his home. The lesson and the warning of this miracle can be clearly seen. According to our faith will our spiritual vision be. So often, perfect faith comes only slowly in a development which begins with the blurred vision of men as trees walking. We need the courage and honesty of the blind man in confessing his immaturity. Finally, our first service, when we have received sight, must be undertaken in the seclusion of our own hearts. There, in worship and gratitude, we may prepare for a dedication which will later find expression in witnessing to his name in the city.